Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. At the end of last week, General Motors announced a third quarter loss of more than $4 billion. Earlier in the week, Ford said it had lost almost $3 billion during that same period. The downturn in the economy has brought auto sales to a near standstill in the U.S., at least as far as the U.S. makers are concerned. It's also driven the CEOs of the big three car makers to Washington in search of help. This morning, we'll be taking a look at the current state of the American auto industry and try to talk a little bit about what lies ahead. And our guest with the program is Kim Hill. He's director of the Automotive Communities Program and associate director of the Economic and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He's joining us this morning by telephone. Questions are welcome, of course. As always, the only thing we ask is that people are brief in their questions and comments, just so we can keep moving and get in as many as possible. But folks are certainly welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, of course, questions, comments are welcome again. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Hill, hello.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And how are you?
Good, good.
Good. Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
Appreciate it. Yeah, pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about the situation of each of the companies, and we can start out with GM since there was the biggest loss. What's going on these days at GM?
Not much. No. Sales are down across the entire segment. In automotive, the economy has hit everybody really hard. We've lost probably 3 million units of sales this year alone, from 16 million at the through last year to about a 13 million sales pace this year. In the midst of all that, certainly General Motors and the other Detroit three companies were trying to adjust their product mix in light of the escalating gas pump prices for the price of a gallon of gas, and they were also restructuring their fleets. A lot of people were moving away from SUVs and pickup trucks before the gas started going really high priced, but so they've kind of been hit from all fronts, and the economic downturn, the recession we're most certainly in right now, and the lack of available credit, which is hampering General Motors' ability more than anybody to sell motor vehicles. The average consumer going into a General Motors dealership is less likely to get the credit to be able to buy a car if they even have the wherewithal to want to buy a car. Mm-hmm. So GM is on all fronts, they're not looking terribly good right at the moment. They were incurring a lot of costs restructuring, meaning that they were trying to shift a lot of their truck production over to cars or the CUV segment, which is sort of a glorified station wagon that look like SUVs, but aren't really truck based. So they were trying to adjust their mix, get back into the competitive. The competitive throws, and it's so frankly, the bottom line of all of that is General Motors is burning through its cash reserves, and they're rapidly dwindling it down, and estimations of General Motors' ability to continue to take money out of its own bank and spend gives them anywhere from a handful of months through possibly mid-summer to stay around, unless they can get some serious revenue flowing back into the company.
And it sounds like the situation at Ford is much the same. Their losses weren't as big, but they did have significant losses, close to $3 billion in the same quarter, and they're doing the same thing. They're burning up their cash reserves too. So for them, it seems pretty much for everybody, it seems that the clock is ticking, and if something doesn't turn around pretty quick, I don't know if the thought is we're thinking if we're going to go from three big companies to two?
Well, you know, if nothing changes pretty quickly, we'd be lucky with two. But, yeah, just to add to that, you know, Ford is certainly in the same situation as General Motors. They're not burning. Ford has a little bit more of a pile of cash. They a couple of years back, mortgaged everything the company owned, so was able to get a lot of money for that, which is saying, you know, saying that they don't actually own anything anymore. But they've got money that should, they're saying they can get all the way through 2009, which hopefully is long enough. But, right, you know, all the companies are not doing that well.
And just to make the point, as you did, that this is not, this is all across auto sales, all across the board, and certainly the American automakers are having a tough time. Are things really any better for those companies that are based in Europe or Asia?
Well, it's better in that those companies, you know, what we've termed, just for analysis sake, are the international companies that are doing business here in North America, and certainly the ones building here. They're, as the Detroit 3 were losing market share, which has been going on since about the mid-90s, steady erosion of their collective market share. It's been replaced by the internationals. So Honda, Toyota, the like, some of the, BMW to a lesser extent, Volkswagen, have been picking up in market share. So Toyota and Honda, up until this economic downturn that we just really all of a sudden, found ourselves firmly in, they were doing well. As Ford and GM were losing or their sales were down, Hondas particularly were up. But now that sales are off so much, so dramatically, they're hitting every company. The difference is that the Asian and European companies have a little bit more of cash on hand. They're in a lot a better financial situation.
Well, just to you talked earlier about the fact, and people now will remember, it wasn't all that long ago, gasoline prices were very high. Now, just the other day, going by a local station where I go, regular is now below $2 a gallon, which is pretty stunning. So the car makers, first of all, were hit by these very high gas prices that affected American companies that had put so much emphasis on these big, heavy vehicles that didn't get very good gas mileage.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the downturn in the economy so that people are pulling back and just refraining from big purchases. And even if they were in the market for a vehicle, then it's become increasingly difficult to get a loan. So all of that stuff has kind of piled onto these companies right at the same time. If though you had to pick out a particular thing, was any of that any more serious than anything else? It seemed that certainly people were talking about a very serious challenge really at the point when gas got to be so expensive and people realized just how much it was costing them to fill up their tanks if they had big SUVs or if they were driving pickups, things like that.
Yeah, well, the thing that we see is like the big thing that hit, certainly the Detroit 3 companies were in a world of hurt just based on their product mix and their lack of forward planning, seeing a day when the price of gasoline may escalate, and so they were not well positioned with vehicles to offer. But they were going through sort of a transformation in a timely fashion, if you will, and had plans in place and had investments, in new products sort of in the pipeline that you could see. Whether or not that was going to rescue them or not, they were making this transition. The big thing that hit was the financial sector crisis in mid-September when, Lehman Brothers failed, the whole litany of AIG and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And all of that collapsed and credit dried up, overnight. And this is not just credit for the consumer, but, it's credit for, a lot of companies would, borrow money on a very short-term basis and pay it back and turn it over and things like that. And a General Motors and a Ford, say, would go to these big financial firms and say, we need to, we're retooling our plant in Chicago, let's say. So we need some money We need to borrow some money over the next year or so to go ahead and do that. Well, all of that money has all of a sudden dried up. So it's frozen what the companies have been able to do, but they still have these plans in place, and if they hope to be a car company that survives and is around after the economic recession, they still have to follow through on these product development cycles. You can't stop developing product, or you can't stop with your plans to put out a vehicle that the consumer wants when they're ready to spend money again. So what they're doing is having to spend money that they normally have on hand as a rainy day fund, if you will, and the rainy day has come and it's pouring right now.
Mm. Well, let me ask you about this, I think that perhaps there are some people who question the big three's commitment to this idea that now they're going to build smaller, more fuel efficient vehicles. They said that they were going to do that, and Congress actually gave them $25 billion in loans to help them do that. And then the last thing that I read is Ford. What do? They pull off the cover, and here is their F-150 for 2009. It gets 16 miles a gallon.
Right,
and I'm sure some people are saying, "What happened? What happened to the move towards more smaller, more fuel efficient vehicles?"
Well, the timing is ironic in that this is a redesigned pickup truck, and these are things that. Even for a model that is already on the market, it has a cycle time 4 or 5 years or so, and before you get to the end of that 5 years, about 3 years into it, you're designing what's the next model going to look like, and so the redesign on that pickup truck actually took place 2 or 2.5 years ago, and investments were made, engineering was done. Retooling of plants, that type of thing. And now it's coming to market right now. So this is the product that's coming out. And sure, it's not the answer to the fuel efficiency needs of an average consumer that's looking for that. But it is, there's a certain segment of the population that absolutely needs a pickup truck. One, if they're a worker, if they are, carpenter, plumber, something like that, in one of the trades, that a pickup truck comes handy. Or if you live in an area of the country where you need a more rugged type vehicle, we know that there's a certain percentage of the population that buys those vehicles. So this is who Ford is addressing. Right now. So they have to follow through with that advertising and let those folks know that these vehicles are out there. If they didn't do that, you could see them take a hit on the sales. I mean, advertising and new cars, go hand in hand. Otherwise, we wouldn't have football games on Sundays,
Yeah. Well, and I suppose it's true. You have to make the point that particularly that vehicle, the F-150, has been one of the big success stories for Ford now for some time.
Yep. It has been. Oh, absolutely. It's the number one seller for the longest time of any vehicle, any vehicle, light truck, pickup truck, small cars, anything. It was the F-Series pickup truck sold almost 1 million units not too long ago, just in the last couple of years. And it was the sales leader year after year after year. So, but to get back to the other side of the equation, you're saying, well, what happened to their newfound commitment to fuel efficiency? Ford and General Motors particularly found that when gas prices started rocketing up there and it got over and above $3 and kept going, that consumers were indeed starting to show up at the showroom and saying, we want a smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicle. And they found to their surprise that Ford, couldn't actually make enough focuses to meet demand. And then General Motors, which is selling their smaller cars like a Cobalt or a Malibu or something, they couldn't make enough of those to meet demand. So Ford was in the midst of, again, before this financial sector crash, was in the midst of bringing more folks on at their assembly plant here in South Michigan to make more focuses and to retool part of the plant that used to make the trucks there. And they also have plans to bring in what we fondly referred to as the European focus for a number of years, which is a much It seems like I was going to say much nicer car, but it's differently. It's a different type of a car. It's something that's it's a small car, but it's a sort of a premium type car. It has a lot of features on it that you don't get here in a small car. Here in the United States, small equates with cheap, whereas in Europe, small, you know, is you know, a regular size car, and so people still want a small car that has a lot of features, and they're willing to pay for it. Here in this country, we haven't been for a long time, so that's coming. And General Motors is certainly, we know they're working on the Chevy Volt, and to a, you know, a little bit under the radar screen is their Chevy Cruze, which is a four-door car that's going to get somewhere about 35, 38 miles to the gallon. So those plans are still going forward. But again, they, you know, GM in particular on the Cruze, because of this credit and cash crunch crisis they're under, find themselves now having to push back the introduction of the Cruze out of Ohio probably by 6 to 9 months, which is unfortunate. But this is where they find themselves. Where do we need money today, and where can we borrow it from tomorrow? And hopefully, we won't get killed by making a decision like that.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580, Kim Hill. He's director of the Automotive Communities Program and associate director of the Economics and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're talking about the U.S. auto industry, where it is right now, where it might be going, and questions are welcome. We have somebody here ready to go. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. The first caller is in Champaign. Line one, right here. Hello.
Hi. Let me give you some information from a consumer. I bought a car recently, and I bought a Subaru. I didn't give a thought to buying an American car. And the reason why is something you're avoiding is that the American automobile makers now are coming out with a product that is so inferior to the Japanese or any place in the world, I think, that I am so angry with the automobile industry, and almost with you for blaming it on the economy. It has nothing to do with the economy. It has to do with what they're doing with their product. Why, you know, you say, okay, the Ford came out with this terrible pickup, and because they had been planning, has already been in the pipeline, so to speak. But you look back 10 years ago, and they should have seen. You know, anybody could have seen where the automobile industry was going to go. I really get angry when I think of this, because I'm so discouraged about the American entrepreneurship. We used to lead the world in it, but now we can't hold a candle to the rest of the world. And I'll take your comments off of here.
All right. Well, Mr. Hill, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree with the terrible planning. I wouldn't say we were avoiding it. I just wasn't sure we'd gotten to that point yet. And I wish the gentleman hadn't gone off the air, because I wanted to know if he was a former Ford or General Motors buyer, because he sounds like a typical one that we hear from a lot, is that, you know, when General Motors and Ford and Chrysler were the only games in the country, those are the only cars you could actually really buy. They did not put good quality products on the road, and they're suffering for it now. The perception that they're building inferior products reigns supreme. I would say that there are some improvements that they could make on some cars. There are independent agencies that check like initial quality and comparative quality amongst motor vehicles, and it's a lot tighter than what you would think. I certainly like these Subarus that are out there, and a lot of times those of us in the Detroit area who see a lot of the Detroit 3 vehicles on the road, and when we see some of the international cars, and I just had the opportunity to travel to Germany recently, you know, you stand around and you point at vehicles and say, you know, look at all of those. Why can't we, you know, either bring those vehicles over to the U.S. or why aren't we building those types of things? I do firmly agree that, you know, the terrible planning. 10 years ago when the companies were making hand over fist from big SUVs and pickup trucks, they should have had somebody in their organization say, hey, what happens if the price of gas goes up? Or what happens if the consumer doesn't want to buy these things anymore? What are we left with? You know, they did not invest in the car side of the equation for a number of years, and it's showing now. They're trying to play catch-up. I firmly believe, though, that, you know, from what I've seen, that given the time to invest in it, and if they do stay the course, the American companies can certainly build something of the type of quality and the type of vehicle that the consumer wants. But I think, like the caller just pretty explicitly pointed out, is that they've lost a lot of customers from their inferior products over the years, and they are suffering right now. And frankly, I think a lot of people would be of the sentiment of, we should just let them fade away.
Well, just we've talked about the fact that it takes a long time to design and build a vehicle.
Yep.
What if, say, one of the companies decided that they were going to take even an existing model line and retool that to make it more fuel efficient, better, have it better looking, better fit and finish, better features, all this kind of stuff. They just decided we're really going to recapture. We want to get Americans excited again about buying American cars.
Mm-hmm.
So even if, and we're not even talking about here about a new model from the ground up. Maybe
yep.
they could take something that they already have
yep.
and make that better. How many years would such a process take?
Well, you know, they're in the midst of it right now. One thing that they're doing in light of the obvious signal from consumers is that they want more fuel efficient vehicles and also something that is of premium quality. They're certainly Ford and General Motors, who have overseas operations, they're starting to look at what little cars, what smaller vehicles, more fuel-efficient vehicles have we designed for other markets that we never thought would sell in the U.S. And, like I said, this European focus that Ford is going to bring over, they're basically bringing that over as it's designed for Europe, and then they're going to build it here. So that can happen, you know, fairly soon, but it takes a little while to retool the assembly plants to get the manufacturing line rigged up so it can build that car. So you could do something like that. I think Ford was looking, about a year that it takes to do that.
Mm-hmm.
These are complex operations. You know, you can't just turn off the lights one night and then the next day come in and start building something else. Unfortunately, it takes a little while, and again, this is where I go back to the lack of planning on the part of some of the automakers. If they'd have thought and had contingency plans in place, or at least said, let's make sure we've got a good wide range of product mix that we're building, then you could escalate your production by just speeding up the line or having more shifts or something like that, and do it on a shorter time frame. It takes a little while. Another thing to point out is the Asian and to a lesser extent European automakers, but certainly Toyota and Honda have gotten really good at being very flexible in their assembly plants, so that they can build, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 different models of vehicle on the same assembly line. And, the U.S. industry has been playing catch-up on that for the better part of at least a decade because they see the advantage of being able to do that. But, again, that's a slow, very capital-intensive process. So we're in the midst of that. They recognize some of these problems. Not to minimize the economy like the caller did, but the economy is a big deterrent at the moment. If you can't add on a room to your house unless somebody lends you money. So same thing applies to the automakers. They can't add on an assembly line or modify an assembly line unless they've got somebody to lend them money. And right now, nobody wants to lend them money.
All right, let's talk with somebody in Urbana. This is line number 2. Hello.
My comments are along the lines of the previous caller and your guest today, David. But I'm wondering, with generations of auto executives and labor union leaders and I guess the eternal John Dingell in the House of Representatives, all of them seem to be of a like psychology in which they really want a status quo that hasn't existed maybe since the 1960s, and seem unwilling to innovate and change. And do you have any comments on that that idea? What leads to this? I mean,
they're unwilling. Whose unwillingness to innovate? Are you talking about the workers or
The unions working? Yeah. I think with corporate management in the big three, and also working through their chief representative, John Dingell of Michigan.
It's an interesting perspective, let me just make clear: our organization is an independent research organization, so we're not advocating for any particular company or segment. We try to take a step back, and it may not sound like that sometimes, but what I think, a representative in Congress, certainly John Dingell, his whole district is made up of a lot of auto workers that are either in plants or are engineers that design vehicles and components and the like. You know, his charge to his constituency is to, keep jobs. And the union is very much the same way. We saw in the latest UAW contract that the union, maybe a little bit late, but noticed that the companies weren't doing so well and that they would have to come to the plate and give some concessions, which, they certainly did to try to make the companies more competitive with the Japanese. It does, from one perspective, and I can understand what you're saying, that they sort of refuse to innovate. They want to keep the status quo.
This goes back to the fight over seatbelts, which I remember as a high school kid.
Yeah. Some of these things, like seatbelts or airbags or I'm trying to think what else. Yeah, certainly environmental regulations, which is where they fight a lot, is to say, if you want us to, if we change our product and it's something we can't pass the cost on to the consumer, the companies then have to, put in safety features or emissions features that again, they're not able to incorporate that into the sales price of a car due to the fierce competition, which again, one points to the internationals and say, well, if a Toyota or Honda can do it and they're not really complaining, what happened with the Detroit?
Yeah, that's my question right there.
Three. And, the Detroit 3 grew up in this country. It evolved. It's been the whole industry, the labor management, partnership, if you will, has evolved over, almost a century now. And, it works fine when you have an economy where workers are working for a plant, in the area, and they're buying the product from that plant, and it kind of stays in a regional economy. So if you're paying somebody a high price wage, and then the product you make is premium priced and the workers can afford it, that kind of works. But once you start globalizing and you have companies come in that say, well, we figured out a way to make things cheaper, higher quality, and the like, and we're going to put them in your market, all of a sudden, you turn around with your home-based company and go, where can we cut costs? And, it's awful tough with I don't want to disparage the union, but when you have a contract is pretty ironclad, whatever it is, if it's a worker contract.
In the U.S. it is.
Yeah, if it's a, if you have a contract with a bank or, anything like that, you kind of have to adhere to it until the contract expires, and then you renegotiate it. So, it's tough. It does tend to.
I mean, is there any introspection among the UAW and the auto companies that maybe our way of doing things should be reorganized? Even at this late date, or are they just stuck in the system that they're in?
I think there is, and I think that there's a there's a you know the folks who haven't worked at in the union for, you know, 25, 30 years, the ones that are the newer employees that are coming along seem to get it a little more, that the world is globalizing and that's the world they have to grow up in. The folks down in are you familiar with the plant over there in Normal, the Mitsubishi plant?
We get news from them as it changes slowly over time.
Well, their fortunes here in North America in sales have never been all that good. They hover around 1% of the market, and they had a downtick in their sales due to some bad financing decisions a few years back. And that plant has, for a few years at least, has had this talk associated with it that plant just may close up and Mitsubishi might not manufacture in the United States. The union, that's a union plant because it was a partnership with Chrysler coming in. So the union just very recently, has been aware of that and been talking to the company, and they signed a fairly progressive agreement there with the union, realizing that we have to do something or else this plant might go away. What can we do? And I think they really came to the table with the company and said, you know, we want to ensure this plant stays here for a long time. We're willing to, give back on some things to make this, to help make this thing more viable of an operation. We just want some faith from the company that you'll look into bringing new product into the plant. We're starting to get some signals that the company is now, the union signed on that and the company agreed to the contract and was very happy about it. Now the company is starting to look at new models that they may be bringing to that plant, in light of, fuel efficiency requirements and the like. So there's like anything, it's very hard to generalize across the board, but we do see bright spots along the way that the workers really do get it, and wherever they can, they want to work with companies. But you got to understand, so some of them changes is very hard. If you've raised a family and put kids through college on your wages that you're getting, it's awful hard to pull back from that.
Thank you.
We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest. We're talking with Kim Hill. He's director of the Automotive Communities Program and associate director of the Economics and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. We're talking about the auto industry. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I have some other callers here real quick, though. One thing I want to have you talk a little bit about is the merger talks that have been going on involving GM and Chrysler.
Yeah.
It seems that there, I'm not sure where that stands right at the moment. There was some interest. They were trying to see, would the government put in any money into this to kind of back the deal? And apparently the Congress said, no, I don't think we want to do that. There are some people who apparently feel that it doesn't actually really make a whole lot of sense to put GM and Chrysler together. Where does this stand now? Is there still some possibility that there might be such a deal? And I suppose the question still stands, well, for Chrysler and GM, does this actually make any sense?
Yeah, well, from what we've heard, the talks are off. I think General Motors pretty explicitly said that on Friday. We'd been kind of sensing that 4 or 5 days before they announced that. The merger talks were one of General Motors' ideas about where could they get some cash. Again, back to what I said earlier in this segment, was that General Motors is going through a lot of cash, $2 to $3 billion a month, and they don't have enough to last through summer at that rate. So one of their ideas was, hey, let's what if we were to merge with Chrysler? Or Chrysler's got a lot of money. Rumor was Chrysler had a lot of money on the table and that they could access that. But we always thought they wouldn't be able to access it very quickly, because there's a lot of things, if you absorb Chrysler, there's a lot of things you have to do before you get money. We never thought it made sense. For one thing, is there's a terrible redundancy of product between General Motors and Chrysler, but the only thing that would survive in something like that would be Chrysler's minivans and the Jeep, and everything else that Chrysler made, and all the plants and all the workers and all the engineers and all the administrative staff, everybody that weren't associated with those two assembly plants would go away. So you'd see probably very quickly 50,000 job losses from Chrysler. And, you know, we thought that, you know, if that were the case, a lot of the money that was supposedly on the table would have to go to severance packages, paying out, paying off dealerships, which there would be too many of. It just didn't make a lot of sense. It seems like it would distract General Motors from their task at hand, which is trying to survive. So if I were a betting man, I'd say that would never, that's never going to happen. Chrysler may form some alliances with, we see much more favorable, there could be an alliance with Nissan and Renault. There's not as much overlap there. Nissan has certainly been open, publicly open about joining up with Chrysler, not merging with them, having taking a, some sort of an equity stake in them, you know, 20%, let's say. But, you know, so I think General Motors is on its own. And certainly going back to, yeah, would there be federal money for a merger, I think very quickly the politicians figured out they didn't want to be any part of giving money to General Motors and Chrysler to merge together and then, you know, pretty quickly seeing up to 50,000 jobs go away. That could haunt them, you know, a congressman or a senator pretty quickly.
Well, do you think that there's going to be any federal money forthcoming for the U.S. automakers?
I think so. I think that if anybody heard the president-elect's press conference the other day, automotive was one of the first things that he said, and there is a second stimulus package being talked about. You know, frankly, we did a study recently, and it was just a very quick one, back of the envelope, but we saw that, if well, let me just say, you know, General Motors is on track, and as is Ford, and if they don't improve their revenues, they're on track to go bankrupt. You frankly just can't, you know, if you run out of money, you run out of money if you can't cover your costs. If these one or more of these companies were to go bankrupt, there'd be, you know, dramatic impacts on the economy, you know, through all the suppliers that would first of all have no business with the bankrupt company, but then they may go bankrupt themselves due to interrupted cash flow and the like. It would have a ripple effect through the economy and could cost you know, billions of dollars, you know, upwards of like $100 billion in lost taxes and the like coming through to the federal government and transfer payments, things like that. So the alternative is that, well, what if the government were to free up some money, sort of do what's being referred to as a bridge loan to these, make available to these companies some money, you know, to get through this economic recession and then see what happens from there. If the federal government was putting up, you know, $25, $50 billion against a potential hundreds of billions of dollars hit on the economy, it would seem to be the cheaper end of the deal. So, you know, that's my guess, is that a lot of things seem to be pointing toward some sort of assistance for these companies, just to, you know, much in the same way as the federal government is putting money out to the investment banks and the like who have made bad loans, is that let's put some money out there, let's try to get these bad loans off the books, and then hopefully these companies can survive and continue on. I don't think in this regard the auto industry is really any different, except if you were to put some of this money into the industry, what you're probably going to get out in the longer run is you know, some sort of tangible product. So,
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Let's go to next line, number three. Somebody, I believe, on a cell phone. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I appreciate the guest being on. I know everybody's disagreeing with him a lot, but it's great that we got this discussion going. I'm always curious. Well, I guess the first thing I ought to say is we bailed these guys out before, and they always go back to, as far as I'm concerned, they always go back to the way they are before, just, you know, kind of, well, we're going to make more, you know, American crap, and we're going to, you know, depend on customer loyalty to buy it. And I guess my first question would be, you know, do we have any assurance that they just won't go back to doing the same thing?
I don't think there's any real assurance. I think that, in the case of the federal government just recently appropriated some money for the low-interest loans, those were based on the companies investing in new technologies, new programs and the like that are going to produce more fuel-efficient vehicles. And there's a lot of safeguards conditions in place that say you can't borrow this money unless it's going to go toward one of those products. So in that case, there is. In this second stimulus package I'm talking about, I think some of the details certainly remain to be worked out. It's just in the theoretical stage right now. But they could indeed, continue along on that vein, is say we do want to get to more fuel efficient vehicles. We if this is what it takes, if we put this money out, you have to invest it in these types of technologies. You've got a great point in that, certainly we bailed out Chrysler a while back, and back in the early 80s, and Chrysler actually paid back the federal government. But it's kind of like when will they learn and say, we need to not make so much of one thing where maybe we're making a lot of profits, but we can't ignore other segments. These are full-line manufacturers, and they turned away from cars for the longest time, and now they're suffering because of it.
Yeah, well, my opinion is that they're learning that the federal government will bail them out when they get in trouble.
Yeah.
What? And I don't know whether you can comment on this or not, but what do they get out of paying CEOs zillions of dollars? I've always kind of wondered if they wouldn't grab the first educated guy that they could and pay him a lot less if they couldn't make as good a decision.
Right. Well, interesting, Ford went outside of the auto industry when they hired Alan Mulally from Boeing, thinking that probably some fresh blood there, although it's still a manufacturing industry and they're still paying him lots of money, that maybe he'll have some good ideas and could force the issue a little more. I think that, what you're asking is, it's not just auto specific, obviously. It's, what do you get from the high-priced CEOs? And I don't know. If one were to, go on a common metric, like, okay, we hired you at point A, and now X number of years later at point B, have you improved the company or not? And then, based on that, we should figure out what do we compensate you, or do you even have a job? If that was the case, at some of these companies, the answer would be no, you wouldn't have a job. So, and then there's the argument that, in the middle, in midstream, is not the right time to change CEOs. But when the boat is upside down, you a new captain isn't really going to help right there. So you better have the guy there that at least knows how to sail it continue forward. I don't know. This is one where I don't have much stamina for defending them. So I guess I probably agree with what you're thinking.
We have about 5 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Okay. We have a number of callers here. We'll try to get in a couple more. Our guest, by the way, is Kim Hill. He is the Associate Director of the Economics and Business Group at the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Questions welcome here. We'll go right on to the next, and that's someone calling from Oak Forest, line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have some comments about Fords. We've been a Ford family probably for 20 years. We keep our cars average of 8-plus years. We mostly drove Tauruses, but some of their other models. We never had any major repairs. They were reliable, and we like buying American. And there are good American cars, despite the opinions this morning. Right now, I drive a Ford Escape Hybrid. It is fantastic. Unfortunately, most of them are going to California, so you have to order them when you want one in the Midwest and wait for it to come in. But I even have met other people in the area with the Escape Hybrid, and they said, how do you like it? And I said, it's great. And they say the exact same thing, top-notch. But talk about the Ford Focus in Europe. We rented one in Ireland a year ago, May, from Hertz, and it was a piece of junk. Uncomfortable seats that couldn't be adjusted, uncomfortable placement of the steering wheel and the other instruments that you have to handle, road terrible. So I don't know that the Ford Focus from Europe would do any better here than, I think the one here is probably better than the one in Europe. I don't care how many fancy seats or leather seats or whatever they would put in. And basically, we thought the piece of the car was not up to Ford standards.
Well, you can comment on that any way you like, Ms. Jones.
Well, I think it's all in the eyes of the beholder, certainly. And I think that, bringing a vehicle here, there's certain different needs of, the American public, a European focus, I didn't mean to imply it would be exactly the same car. I think that they would modify, put in, seats that are more comfortable for Americans who like to drive their vehicles a lot further, the like. I think what I was trying to say is that there's technologies out there, there's platforms, there's products that certainly these companies can learn from and bring over here quickly and adapt. I think that was probably more of what I was trying to say. I agree with the caller. I love the Ford Escape Hybrid, and they're excellent. I think there's a shortage of them because they get the hybrid technology, some of it from Toyota, and there's not enough to go around right now. But Ford's working on that.
I want to thank the caller and go to get at least one more. We'll go to Champagne. This is the next person in line. Line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Just one comment and then one sort of a confirmation request. One is that the Toyota CEO, there was mention of the CEO earlier, makes about $600,000 a year, and I don't think there are stock options either, so which is incredibly shocking to a lot of Americans. But anyway, as for one thing I wanted to confirm is that am I correct in saying that, at least this was based on Consumer Reports a couple of years back, as of 2005 at least, that the Japanese automakers made more cars in America than the American Big Three, roughly, slightly more. That's from what I understood from some articles and data in Consumer Reports, but I'm just curious whether you know anything about that.
Well, no, that's not right.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think maybe across certain segments, perhaps, and maybe it was. Because Toyota is importing close to 50% of the motor vehicles that they sell in this country, and Honda's importing about 25% of them, whereas Ford and GM and Chrysler are pretty much building close to 90%. When you start to include Canada and Mexico, they build pretty much 100% of the vehicles that they sell here.
Right, my sense was there was very large in Mexico and Canada, and certainly the percentage numbers from the charts they had seemed to add up higher by about 0.1% than the American makers.
Well, build hasn't caught up yet, and we do show a trajectory where it will catch up the production, but sales are definitely more. So sales, they sell more than the big three together. So that's one segment. And then production is, what are they building here? If trends do follow and the big three continue to downsize and the internationals continue to invest in this country, we do see production in the mid part of, 2015, 16, somewhere around there, that production will overtake the domestic, what used to be the domestic companies.
And R&D is even quite a bit higher, right, on the Japanese side? I'm just curious about that.
No, it's not. No, there's a lot more R&D here, a lot of platforms and engines and the real brain, guts of the motor vehicles for the Japanese is designed over in Tokyo. That all the hybrid technology is designed in Japan.
Right, right.
We've been talking to them for a while, saying, that's one area where you could be investing a lot more in this
country. Right, in the States, yeah.
Yeah, don't just outsource your manufacturing. Outsource your the brains of your
company. Right. Well. Now, that's a very good point. I think in terms of overall, the company itself spends a lot, I think, on R&D. That was my sense, at least, from
They're doing that. Toyota. It's not all here, but I think over time that will evolve.
Thank you.
All right. One more, Avon, Indiana. That's line three. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, sir. How are you, folks?
Good. Go ahead.
Question, follow-up question regarding to what do you get with today's CEOs, not only in the auto industry, but, you know, with American corporations? Basically, you get nothing because there's no responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Well, again, it goes back. Still, it goes back to this question of are we rewarding people even if the corporate performance isn't what we would like? It seems that in the past that's continued to happen. Is it likely that that's going to change?
Well, now you're getting out of my league. Now I'm going to give you a personal opinion, but I agree. I think what we've rewarded CEOs on is do they push the stock price up? So are the investors making more money? And it's less about the product than it is about the investor in the company. And it's very discouraging and disappointing. And those are the two mildest words I could use. But this whole talk about merging. A lot of times CEOs come in and merge with another company, push the stock price of one of them up, lay off a whole bunch of workers, and they walk away with a big, huge bonus. But is the company any better in the long run? No, typically not.
Well, we're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say we have a couple of callers we can't take. I'm sure we'll continue to follow developments in the industry, but for the moment we have to leave it there with thanks to our guest, Kim Hill. He is director of the Automotive Communities Program and associate director of the Economics and Business Group for the Center for Automotive Research based in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Mr. Hill, thanks very much.
All right, David, thank you for having me.